Perhaps we'll go ahead and get started. Good morning. My name is Fred Niedner from Valparaiso, Indiana, serving my last day of the summer as not Walt. Filling in this week for Professor Walter Bowman, good friend who is not able to be here teaching as scheduled this week because of his serious illness. The series that we're finishing is called Beyond Words, Wilderness Sojourns for People in Transition, which at any given time is any or all of us. And we've been starting in the theme text for the summer, Moses at the Burning Bush, at the beginning of his own wilderness experience. And we've been launching off into different pieces of wilderness tradition of one kind or another all week, and that's what we'll do again today. But as has been the pattern, we'll start with alleged hilarity. Now, I don't know exactly how to introduce this piece in a such a way that it connects very closely to the theme or even to Beyond Words, although I suppose in a way worship wars, which is what this is really about, take us into areas beyond words and leave us speechless. But this is simply a little story about the confusion that gets generated nowadays on occasion in the church about our attempts to worship together in ways that everybody can feel comfortable with. It seems that there was an old farmer who went to the city one weekend and attended a big city church. He came home and his wife asked him how it was. "Well," said the farmer, "it was good. They did something different, however. They sang praise choruses instead of hymns." "Praise choruses?" said his wife. "What are those?" "Oh, they're okay," said the farmer. "They're sort of like hymns, only different." "Well, what's the difference?" asked his wife. The farmer said, "Well, it's like this. If I were to say to you, 'Martha, the cows are in the corn,' well, that would be a hymn. If, on the other hand, I were to say to you, 'Martha, Martha, Martha, oh, Martha, 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 the cows, the big cows, the brown cows, the black cows, the white cows, the black and white cows, 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 cows are in the corn, in the corn, in the corn, 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 corn.'" "Then, if I were to repeat that whole thing two or three times, well, that would be a praise chorus. As luck would have it, the exact same Sunday, a young new Christian from the city church attended the farmer's small town church. He came home and his wife asked him how it was. "Well," said the young man, "it was good. They did something different, however. They sang hymns instead of regular songs." "Hymns?" says his wife. "What are those?" "Oh, they're okay. They're sort of like regular songs, only different," said the young man. "Well, what's the difference?" asked his wife. The young man said, "Well, it's like this. If I were to say to you, 'Martha, the cows are in the corn,' well, that would be a regular song. If, on the other hand, I were to say to you, 'Oh, Martha, dear Martha, hear thou my cry, inclinest thine ear to the words of my mouth, turn thou thy whole wondrous ear by and by to the righteous, inimitable, glorious truth, for the way of the animals who can explain? There in their heads is no shadow of sense. Hearkenest they in God's sun or his rain, unless from the mild tempting corn they are fenced." "Yea, those cows in glad bovine rebellious delight have broke free their shackles, their warm pens eschewed. Then, goaded by minion of darkness and night, they all my mild Chilliwack sweet corn have chewed." "So look to that bright shining day by and by, where all foul corruptions of earth are reborn, where no vicious animal makes my soul cry, and I no longer see those foul corn, foul cows in the corn. Then, if I were to do only verses 1, 3, and 4, and do a key change on the last verse, well, that would be a hymn." So, Now you know how to explain it all. Well, today we're going to go a little farther afield than usual from Exodus 3 and start just by with the reminder of having noted yesterday, or I just said it, we didn't look at it, that there are two radically different pictures of the wilderness sojourn in the biblical tradition. The materials we were looking at yesterday make the whole story of the wilderness from beginning to end look like one long wrangle of murmuring and complaining and rebellion and near destruction of the people because of God's frustration. The same picture appears in Psalm 78. It appears in the summary of the books of Moses that is read before the people in Ezra and Nehemiah at the time of the return from exile. But there is another view of the wilderness, and that's primarily in the prophetic tradition. In the prophetic tradition, the wilderness was understood somewhat differently, as indicated, for example, by this piece of Jeremiah, Jeremiah chapter 2. The word of the Lord came to me, saying, "Go proclaim in the hearing of Jerusalem, thus says the Lord, I remember the devotion of your youth, your love as a bride, how you followed me in the wilderness in a land not sown. Israel was holy to the Lord, the first fruits of his harvest. All who ate of it were held guilty. Disaster came upon them." But then, "What wrong did your ancestors find in me that they went far from me and went after worthless things and became worthless themselves? They didn't say, 'Where is the Lord who brought us up from the land of Egypt, who led us in the wilderness, in a land of deserts and pits, in a land of drought and deep darkness, in a land that no one passes through and no one lives? I brought you into a plentiful land to eat its fruit and its good things. But when you entered, you defiled my land and made my heritage an abomination.'" So there you see the picture. The wilderness was really the good time that we had. And it wasn't until you got into the land that you became perverted somehow and left your faithfulness to me. So that's a very different picture of the wilderness. And you find that in numerous places in the prophetic tradition. I believe that Jeremiah is rather strongly influenced by Hosea a century and a half before. Hosea, for example, has this little snippet in chapter 9. "Like grapes in the wilderness I found Israel, like the first fruit on the fig tree in its first season, I saw your ancestors. But they came to Baal Peor and consecrated themselves to a thing of shame and became detestable like the thing they loved." So there's no hint of apostasy in the prophet's thinking until they get to the end of the journey and they get mixed up with the Baal religion. Even Amos, who doesn't have much to say about the history of the people, speaks of the wilderness journey as a kind of a pure experience where they didn't even need to sacrifice. And for 40 years didn't need such things because they weren't sinning. I'd like to plop down in Hosea at another place, however, and spend a bit of time seeing just what the wilderness means to Hosea and use it to get a picture of a remarkable understanding of the relationship of God and Israel in the prophetic tradition that we sometimes overlook. So turn, please, to the beginning of the book of Hosea, Hosea 1 and 2. The prophet Hosea doesn't excuse me, doesn't tell us how he got into the work of being a prophet. He doesn't have one of those call narratives. The book begins with the story of Hosea's marriage to a woman named Gomer, who is some sort of prostitute, either a cult prostitute in the religion of the Canaanites, something that the prophetic tradition was always critiquing, or perhaps a prostitute who simply worked the streets, as we say nowadays. It's hard to tell, and there's been arguments both ways. But God tells Hosea to marry a prostitute and to have children by her, to dramatize the fact that by getting involved with the Baal religion, Israel has prostituted itself and been unfaithful to the Lord. So Hosea goes and does this and has three children with this woman. The first of them is named Jezreel. That's a play on the name of the place that the current dynasty had acquired its power and become the dynasty in Samaria. But the second and third child are the ones whose names tell us what the real point of this dramatic act is. The second child's to be named Lo Ruhamah, which sounds kind of pretty, except that it means something rather bizarre translated into English. Translated in some Bibles as not pitied or not loved. Ruhamah is a word for compassion. No one has compassion on this person. I think the way to understand the effect that was intended would be to translate it, no one cares. So that you ask this little girl eventually what her name is when she goes to school, and she says, no one cares. And you ask eventually her children who their mom is, and they'll say, no one cares. And someday it'll say on her tombstone, nobody cares who's buried here. The next child is named Lo-Ami, not my people. If you realize the different words for people in Hebrew, Am, this one, means real people, us. The other word for people in Hebrew is Goy, which some of you may know from Yiddish, the Goyim. That's everybody else who isn't us. It's sort of like, there are lots of languages that do that. In the Cheyenne language of Native Americans, Cheyenne means human beings. And then there's all the rest of them. Not exactly sure what they are, but we are Cheyenne. That's what Am and Goy really is. So not my people really means to have the identity of nobody. So you ask that person's children someday, whose child are you? Nobody's. And on his tombstone it'll say, nobody's buried here. So the point is, you live without identity when you forsake Yahweh. You become no one. You are outside of a relationship of love and care. So that's the first dramatic act. The second chapter of Hosea is written in the form of a lawsuit, which is a bill of divorce. In ancient times, if you wanted to divorce your spouse, and it was something mostly only men could do, you simply wrote out a bill of divorce, and all you had to say was, this person is no longer my wife, give at least one reason, give it to the person, and that was that. It was sort of like the opposite of a receipt. You know, it was an anti-receipt or something, you know, a renunciation of property. And that was simply how life was back then. Sadly enough, that every woman was some man's property, either a husband's or a father's or someone's. And that's how the next of kin business worked, as I'm sure most of you have heard. Women could get divorced, by the way, for very, very few reasons. If you read Mishnah and Talmud, for example, you can see that there were allowed a few... women could divorce a husband for a few reasons. Some of them would sound kind of strange today. For example, if you're a woman who was married to a tanner and you found that you simply could not tolerate the odor that was on the man's skin, which if you were a tanner, you worked with these acids for tanning hides that got on your skin and you simply could not get the smell off of you. It was impossible, at least back then. And so if you were a woman married to a tanner and you found that this odor simply made you sick, you had the right to insist on a bill of divorce, and your husband had to give it to you. So there were a few things like that. But a man could divorce someone for almost any reason. But in this case, the bill of divorce is about unfaithfulness. And it begins with that word that we saw pulled on Moses yesterday out there when they realized there was a water shortage that was unanticipated. They sued. Well, the very same word opens the oracle in Hosea chapter 2. Plead with your mother. It's the word for plead and the word for complain are the same word in Hebrew, actually. Reev. This is a lawsuit word. File suit with your mother. File suit. She is not my wife, and I am not her husband. That's all you had to say in a bill of divorce. The rest was just the particulars. That she put away her whoring from her face, her adultery from between her breasts, or I will strip her naked and expose her in the day she was born. A husband had the right, if he caught a wife in unfaithfulness, to have her taken out by the city gates and stoned to death. This is what was about to happen in that piece of John 8 that is a bit contested as to whether or not it's actually there in the text. Upon her children also I will have no pity, because they're children of harlotry. Their mother has played the harlot. She who conceived them acted shamefully, and so forth. And then there comes a series of clauses that you use in a lawsuit of this kind that begin with the word therefore. This is the further stipulations of this lawsuit. Therefore, I will hedge up her way with thorns. I will build a wall against her so that she cannot find her paths to pursue her lovers, and so forth. Verse 9, therefore, I will withhold all the stuff I've been giving her. The grain, the wine, the wool, the flax, and so forth. In other words... I'm not going to do child support and alimony or whatever. I'm just cutting this woman off from all the stuff that I've been giving her. There's a third therefore clause, which you would expect, if you understand this form, to be the final disposition of cutting a relationship, but look what you have instead. Therefore, I will now allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak tenderly to her. Sudden switch from divorce to, let's go have another honeymoon. The word for allure is one of the words in Hebrew used elsewhere in the Bible for seduction. You know, so in effect, God says, no, I think we'll go back out to the wilderness where we started and things were good, and I will whisper in her ear. I will say sweet things. And there I will give her vineyards and make the valley of Achor a door of hope, a place where a terrible thing had happened. There she'll respond as in the days of her youth, back when we were young, me and Israel, as at the time when she came out of the land of Egypt. On that day, says the Lord, you'll call me my husband. You won't roll over in your sleep anymore and call me Baal. Oh, I used to hate that. I'll remove the names of Baal from her mouth. And we'll have a covenant with the whole of creation. And I will take you for my wife forever. I'll take you for my wife in righteousness and justice and steadfast love and mercy. We'll rename the kids so that they are cared for and surely my people. So, right there in the middle of the bill of divorce, God has a sudden change of heart. Lives up, as it were, to that reputation that we were citing the other day. Gracious and merciful, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love, and repents of the evil that God threatens to do against people. This is a piece of the prophetic genius, this business of God and Israel being tied to each other in a relationship like this, where in a sense neither one can let go of the other. God, the way the prophets understand it, God has staked God's reputation in the whole world on this people, and once God has done that, God can't let go of this people. The whole opening to the Bible, Genesis 1 to 11, is set up to show that Israel is God's last hope in a world that has known only curse up to this point. This is the last hope. The alternative is to nuke the place again with water or with something. But through this tiny people, God will seek to work blessing in the earth instead of curse. And if it doesn't work, the alternative is unspeakable, unthinkable. And that's, you know, over and over again we see the prophets showing us the heart of God and the dilemma it is for God to think about severing ties with this people. God just can't do it. On the other hand, without God, Israel is nothing. Israel is lo ruhama and lo ami, nothing, nobody, utterly without pity on the face of the earth. So,
Fred?
Yeah.
In 2:16, where you have the husband Baal contrast.
Yes.
Do you know what the Hebrew is for husband, and what's the intended contrast? Is it one of intimacy or one of relationship?
Well, my husband there is simply Ishi. It's the word. It's the simplest word for what a man is to a woman, as opposed to Baal, which is both. I mean, Baal in Hebrew is a word for a overseer, but it's also this name for the Canaanite god. So it's simply a return to a return to an older relationship and getting rid of a false lover. I mean,
is it the same as in Genesis 2?
Ish and Isha?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you could say it's a word of intimacy and relationship as opposed to one of control or master, in the sense of there's endearment rather than relationship based on requirements.
You could read that into it, yeah, but I think it's just simpler. I think it's just the difference between husband and lover, mentioning the lover by name. Although there was all, I mean, the prophets do understand that the Baal worship was buying into something that would destroy them with requirements. I mean, the prophetic tradition had a little bit different relationship to the sacrificial system than the rest of the powers that be in Israel. So there would be some people who wouldn't have known to make a distinction between the requirements of the Yahweh religion and the requirements of the Baal religion. The priestly tradition would have laid just as many requirements as the Baal religion on people, but the prophets wouldn't have done that. So there may be some of that, that it's the difference between a simple relationship and a relationship of servitude. Yeah. There's another remarkable text in Hosea that illustrates this business of a God and people who cannot give each other up, that we'll look at briefly in Hosea chapter 11. This remarkable oracle is also written in the form of a legal proceeding that you would do in a certain circumstance. According to Deuteronomy 21, verses 12 and following, if you have a rebellious child and you have done everything you know of to discipline this child so that you can live with this child, and this child will abide by the rules of the community and the household, and you have simply failed at this and the child is a rebel, you take the child to the city gates, to where the elders sit, and you explain to the child all that you have tried, and you catalog the rebellious behaviors of the child, and then, according to Deuteronomy 21, you and the elders together will stone this child to death, and your eye shall have no pity, and let all Israel fear and learn not to do this kind of stuff.
True.
So there was no juvenile detention center outside these cities. We don't know if they actually did this, but this was the law on the books. Hosea 11 is written in the form of what a parent says to the elders at the city gates when they have attempted to discipline a child and failed.
Where do you say that's found?
Deuteronomy 21, verses 18 to 21. When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. The more I called them, the more they went from me, sacrificing to the Baals, offering incense to idols. I taught Ephraim to walk. Ephraim is another name for technically the northern kingdom. I carried them in my arms. They didn't know that I was the one who healed them. I led them with cords of human kindness, with bands of love. I was to them like one who held them to my cheek. I bent down to them and fed them, and the word is actually nursed them. They shall return to the land of Egypt, and Assyria shall be their king, because they have refused to return to me. The sword rages in their cities and consumes their oracle priests and devours because of their schemes. My people are bent on turning from me. To the Most High they call, but he does not raise them up at all. So I raised this child. I brought this child through the wilderness. I was kind to this child. I taught this child to walk. I did everything for this child, and now this child does nothing but rebel against me. I guess this child has to be destroyed. That's the point. But then, just as in the decree of divorce, there is a sudden change of heart at verse 8. How can I give you up, Ephraim? How can I hand you over, O Israel? How can I make you like Admah, treat you like Zeboim? Those were two outlying cities next to Sodom and Gomorrah, according to the tradition of Deuteronomy. And so the point is, how could I do my Sodom and Gomorrah act on you, which is sort of the ultimate stoning that you could imagine out by the city gates. My heart recoils within me. My compassion grows warm and tender. The word for recoils there, does somebody have a different translation, by the way?
NIV is changed.
Changed, my heart is changed. The word there is actually the word used in Genesis 19 for what God did to Sodom and Gomorrah. So the point is, when I even think about doing to you what happened to Sodom and Gomorrah, which is what you really deserve, that very same destruction happens to my heart, God says. My compassion catches fire. There's a textual difficulty here. There are two words in Hebrew for compassion. One of them means womb. To have compassion on somebody is to treat them like they were once in your womb. It's a great image. So you treat someone as though they are your own flesh and blood. But there's another word from compassion that has to do with breathing. Rhythmic breathing. And I don't know exactly what the poetry is there, whether you're to imagine holding a child in such a way that the child can feel your breath, the rhythms of your body, or feel your breath on their little head or whatever. But both these words seem to be motherly parenting words. So, by the way, the word for recoil there, my heart recoils within me, the same expression is used for what happens to women who die in childbirth. Remember when Israel loses the ark and the messengers come running to tell the people back home that is it Hophni and Phinehas have been killed in the battle, and Eli's daughter-in-law hears this news that her husband is dead, and her womb recoiled and she died. She was pregnant. She was at the point of delivery at this moment. So, you know, this is the violence related to mothering that happens to God at the very thought of giving over her child at the city gate to the punishment that the child deserves. So I won't execute my fierce anger, God says. I will not again destroy Ephraim because I'm God, not a mortal. I'm the Holy One in your midst. I will not come in wrath. So there God says, what makes me God and not a mortal is that I can make this kind of change. I can take this pain and not destroy my child. That's Hosea's way of saying this reputation, gracious and merciful and even repents of evil. We all know, however, that shortly after Hosea makes these oracles, the northern kingdom was destroyed. The Assyrians came and they did wreak havoc on this place. The child did end up destroyed at the city gates and was never again restored. But according to Hosea's prophecy, God would not be the one there are other prophets who would say differently, but Hosea's oracle, or at least its implications, is that God does not participate in throwing those stones. God remains the Holy One in the midst of this people who takes the blows of the stones along with the child. So instead of participating in the execution, God sits in the midst of the people and holds them through the ordeal. Which I would say as a Christian is a very ancient piece of what we now call theology of the cross. There's another story that turns out to be like this, that doesn't begin in the wilderness unless you do a bit of stretching, and we don't have time to account for the stretching. We'll just go there. I promised you a few days ago to give you a clue about a piece of soap opera in the Bible. How in the world did Jacob get through a whole night on his wedding without realizing he was with the wrong woman? Well, it's a long story, but there is an answer. And so we'll go there next, because that story ends where we just were, pardon me, in the heart of God with Hosea. Back to Genesis 29 is where we'll start. So Jacob ends up married to both Rachel and Leah. Rachel was the wife that he really wanted, and Laban, his father-in-law, tricks him. So now he's married to both women, but he loves Rachel and he does not love Leah. And the narrator says in verse 31 of chapter 29, when the Lord saw that Leah was unloved, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. So the implication seems to be that God was doing a bit of birth control here, if you will, stage managing things a bit so that unloved Leah bears children repeatedly and Rachel bears none at all by God's design. Leah's story is beautiful and could take up the next hour all by itself, but we don't have time to go there. We'll do that some other year. Genesis 30, verses 1 and 2, begins with Rachel's frustration and even anger over this. When Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, she envied her sister, and she said to Jacob, "Give me children or I shall die." Prophetic word, we'll find. Jacob became very angry with Rachel and said, "Am I in the place of God who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb?" So they all understand now that Rachel's difficulty is with God. Or at least that's what Jacob would have her believe. And of course we know, because we're in on the narrator's thinking, that that's what we're supposed to think. At the end of that chapter, verses 22 and following, we read that finally God remembered Rachel, and God heeded her and opened her womb. She conceived and bore a son and said, "God has taken away my reproach." And she named him Yosef, which means do it again, or let it happen again, or let there be another. So that, this is a good trick Rachel pulled. So now every time somebody comes to her home and says, "What's your baby's name?" and she says, "Yosef," and they say, "Yosef," they join her prayer that there will be another. So she's now got everybody who knows her child's name praying with her that she will start catching up with Leah, that she will have another and maybe more. Because as long as Joseph lives, people will say that prayer with Rachel. Well, it doesn't happen for a while. But all the way up in Genesis 35, verses 16 and following, we find that Jacob and family are out on the road, they happen to be near a place that we know now as a place very near Bethlehem. They journeyed from Bethel, and when they were still some distance from Ephrath, Rachel was in childbirth, and she had hard labor. When she was in her hard labor, the midwife said to her, "Do not be afraid, for now you will have another son." And her soul was departing, for she died. She named him Ben-Oni, which means son of my sorrow. It's a little stronger than sorrow. It's more like devastation, affliction, desolation. Son of my sorrow. But his father called him Benjamin, which means son of the right hand, literally, son of favor, son of... well, that's pretty good. Favorite son. So Rachel died, and she was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is, Bethlehem. And Jacob set up a pillar at her grave. It is the pillar of Rachel's tomb, which is there to this day. Israel journeyed on and pitched his tent beyond the Tower of Adar. Well, Rachel's tomb is there to this day. Some of you may have been to Israel and seen it. A few years ago, they put a brand new big tall wall around it to help keep Palestinians away from it. And the Palestinians protested, mostly a bunch of kids protested, and so they were shot. So there was a lot of mourning at and around Rachel's tomb. Once again, in recent times, it became another place of terrible tragedy that made the news, and so there's still a lot of sadness at that place. But let's think about this story just for a moment. Because her husband loved her more than her sister, through no fault of her own, God closed Rachel's womb. So she cries out to her husband that she must have children or she'll die. And she turns her first child that she finally bears into a prayer for more, and the answer to her prayer kills her, which is exactly what is foreshadowed in her first expression of frustration. And with her dying breath, she names her child for her sorrow. And as an act of kindness, for sure, the father renames this boy. Who would want to go around named, you know, son of devastation, son of desolation? So, as an act of kindness, Jacob changes the boy's name. But in doing so, he silences Rachel's voice. He silences Rachel's tears. So that, unlike with Joseph, this voice is now stopped. And this is the last we hear of Rachel in the tradition. For 1,000 years, she is not mentioned. The next time we hear of Rachel in the biblical tradition is when Jeremiah, 1,000 years later, in chapter 31, writes an oracle, Jeremiah 31, 15 and following, if you want to be turning to it. Jeremiah writes an oracle that comes from his having apparently watched as the Babylonians, who have conquered the city of Jerusalem and subdued the whole people of Judah, are preparing to march them off on forced marches into exile. And this was a dreadful and devastating thing to watch, because the Babylonians had learned from the Assyrians before them the tactic of moving people in large groups in forced marches from one part of an empire to another by stripping them naked to make them more docile. The word for going into exile in the Hebrew language is the word for being naked. To go naked is what is the expression for going into exile. And that's because that's what the Babylonians, like the Assyrians before them, did. They stripped you and marched you off on the theory that you were less likely to organize a rebellion in that condition. And as you will obviously imagine, few people made it. It was a wretched experience. And Jeremiah watched the staging of the forced marches in this territory where near where he lived, where he had formerly lived, and where they were out in the neighborhood of Rachel's tomb. And Jeremiah says this, "Thus says the Lord, a voice is heard in Ramah, lamentation and bitter weeping. Rachel is weeping for her children. She refuses to be comforted for her children because they are no more." So here is a voice that cries out over children who are lost, some to the sword and some to these terrible forced marches. And Rachel weeps inconsolably for these people whom she died giving birth to. I mean, these are her children 1,000 years later. This is the people that has come from Yosef and Ben Oni Ben Yamin. And so she weeps inconsolably, having witnessed from her grave the slaughter of her offspring. You know this verse as well from Matthew's Gospel. When Matthew quotes Jeremiah to give voice to the great sorrow that comes when Herod's guys come to the same territory and slay all the children of Bethlehem, this time Rachel's children die in the place of the child Jesus, the single one to escape from Herod's murderous rampage. And Matthew says, "Then was fulfilled what was spoken through the prophet Jeremiah. A voice was heard in Ramah, wailing in loud lamentation, Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be consoled because they are no more." So almost a perfect quote, exact quote, which Matthew doesn't usually do. Matthew usually plays with texts, but this one he kind of leaves alone. Well, what I want to try to show you in the next few minutes is that Matthew could hardly have told this story without that verse, given how important this verse had become in the tradition of his people, the Jewish people. I didn't read the whole oracle of Jeremiah 31, 15 to 17. I deliberately. After Rachel's tears, this is startlingly what comes next. "Thus says the Lord, keep your voice from weeping and your eyes from tears, for there is a reward for your work, says the Lord. They shall come back from the land of the enemy. There is hope for your future, says the Lord. Your children shall come back to their own country." The ancient rabbis asked, how come there is such a rapid switch in that oracle from Rachel's disconsolate weeping to God's insistence that she quit that weeping? And God declares very strongly, "Your children will be back. I will return them." That quick change from Rachel's weeping to God's response has made this an extraordinarily important text in the history of Judaism. To this day, it's used as the reading primary reading for the second day of the High Holy Days, the second day of Rosh Hashanah. The reading highlights the fact that there are voices that God cannot ignore, that God simply will answer, and they are voices like Rachel's. I want to share with you a couple of stories called Midrash. Midrashim is plural, Midrash is singular. Midrashim that the rabbis told, and we don't know the precise ages of these things because they weren't copyrighted and dated in the way that we try to do with literature. So we don't know whether these are pre-Christian, but some elements of these may well be. But anyway, these are the stories that make this so important. The rabbis tell a midrash when there's a mystery to be solved in a text, or when there's an omission of a step of some kind, and you have to explain something that appears to be a gap in a story. So a midrash is a story about a story. It's not a piece of the canon, but it's a way to try to interpret the canon. The story goes that even God wept over the destruction of Jerusalem, and God wanted company at this weeping over Jerusalem when the Babylonians destroyed it. And so God calls some of the ancient worthies from their graves to come weep with God, and starts with Abram, and Abram says, "Well, no, I'm not going to come weep with you. When I had my hand poised with the knife over my son Isaac up on the mountain where you told me to go, you stopped that. You kept me from slaying my son. You could have stopped the slaughter of this people." So God calls others, eventually Moses. Moses says, "No, I won't come weep with you. When my people got to the Red Sea and were about to be destroyed, you saved us. You could have saved this generation of your people." And God was used to it from Moses. But no one will come weep with God. So finally God calls Rachel. And Rachel comes, and there are two versions to the story, two different ways that the story can go. In the one story, Rachel comes and says, "Yes, God, I will weep with you, but I want you to know one thing. I want you to know, in case you don't, how it was that my husband didn't know who he was sleeping with on the night I was to be married. I was brokenhearted that night to know that my beloved Jacob would be making love to my sister. I also knew that he would be furious if he knew who he was with and he might hurt her. So I snuck into the tent and hid beneath the stuff that was inside the tent. And every time Jacob spoke, I answered so that my husband would not hurt my sister. So and do you know, God, how much that hurt me? So I think, God, that if I could get through that, you could get over your people having been unfaithful to you." And God says, "Okay, I'll give your children back." The other version of the Midrash is slightly simpler. It simply says that Rachel came and wept without consolation for the children. She did not come and make recriminations against God, nor did she come to weep for herself. The text says she wept for the children. And the purity of those tears, that they were not tears against God and they were not tears for herself, moves God to say, "Stop, please. I will give them back." So Rachel became, in the tradition, an extraordinarily important person. Rachel became, in rabbinic theology, something of a character like Elijah, someone whom God dispatched to terribly sad places. Rachel became the one who weeps for people, and they actually, the rabbis began to play with her name, which is Rachel in Hebrew, and it has exactly the consonants of the expression in Hebrew Ruach El, which means Spirit of God. And so she plays the role of the sort of the carrier of the Ruach El, and she weeps for people. And I can't help but wonder, frankly, if there's not a bit of this behind what Paul says when Paul says that the Spirit of God prays for us when we have no words, with cries too deep for words. The Spirit of God, you know. Ever since I learned this midrash, I think Ruach El when I read Romans 8. In the mystical Zohar texts, when the Messianic age is described, there's a wonderful little text that says that when the Messiah comes, the Messiah will spend 30 days waiting between the time that the enemies have been vanquished and the Messianic kingdom will begin, and the 30 days are used to make the decision where the coronation will happen. At the end of the 30-day period of waiting, here is what the Zohar text says, that where shall the crowning be? On the way to Ephrath, at the crossroads, which is Rachel's grave. To Mother Rachel he will bring glad tidings, and he will comfort her. And now she will let herself be comforted, and she will rise up and kiss him. So it's no wonder Matthew couldn't tell the story of the coming of the Messiah without mention of Rachel. Now I've got 2 minutes and a whole bunch more to tell you about where this Rachel stuff all goes. I mean, lots of people have picked up this story and used it very creatively and theologically. Luther has a wonderful sermon, a Christmas sermon on this, in which he lays out a sort of a theology of the cross thing. I'll just read a tiny little snippet. In the godforsakenness of God's own Son on the cross, the promised hope for Rachel is embodied. By not believing any consolation short of God's own descent into hell in Christ, the refusal of Rachel becomes a faithful witness pointing to the resurrection. That's just a snippet, but I think you can get the idea that Rachel's voice is understood by Luther to be a voice that will only accept the most radical possible solution from God as its answer. No cheap answers. A theologian by the name of Christopher Morse at Union Seminary in New York has written a whole book that starts with this story, Book of Systematic Theology, and he names Rachel's refusal of cheap consolation as the starting point for a whole theology. And here's a key line from his book. Wherever we find today the credulity willing to believe anything comfortable that passes itself off as spirituality or God talk, and wherever we find today the cynicism that says there is no hope or faith worth trusting, Rachel's refusal becomes a most timely witness to resurrection faith. So her weeping is a symbol to him of the refusal to take cheap consolation, and also an insistence that there is consolation somewhere. Somewhere there is a God of Rachel who will answer. And those two are the poles of this theology. But I'm going to finish. I'm cheating now because we're slightly over time. I'm going to finish by just reading to you a piece of one of the most poignant uses of the Rachel story anywhere, and that's in Melville's Moby Dick. He gives the name Rachel to a whaling ship in the story, and it becomes clear late in the story why the name Rachel is the perfect name for that ship. The Rachel loses part of her crew in a mishap late in the story, and the captain of the Rachel comes to Ahab at the Pequod to seek help, and Ahab orders him off the ship. Among the people that the Rachel lost is the son of the captain, and so they are just desperate to try to find their lost sailors, and they're ordered off by Ahab. And as the two ships then part, and the Rachel goes lurching off into the heavy seas, Melville writes, "By her still halting course and winding woeful way, you plainly saw that this ship that so wept with spray still remained without comfort. She was Rachel, weeping for her children because they were not." And then, you know how the story ends, with the Pequod sinking, and Ishmael, the sole survivor, almost gets caught in the whatever you call that, when the vortex, I guess, when the ship goes down and all sucks everything down with it, and up pops this coffin. And Ishmael clings to the coffin. And at the end of the story, then I'll read this if I can get through it. The story of Ishmael's account of his being miraculously saved. "So floating on the margin of the ensuing scene and in full sight of it, when the half-spent suction of the ship, sunk ship, reached me, I was then but slowly drawn towards the closing vortex till the coffin life buoy shot lengthwise from the sea, fell over and floated by my side. Buoyed up by that coffin, for almost one whole day and night I floated on a soft and dirge-like mane. The unharming sharks, they glided by as if with padlocks on their mouths. The savage seahawks sailed with sheathed beaks. On the second day, a sail drew nearer and picked me up at last. It was the devious cruising Rachel, that in her retracing search after her missing children, only found another orphan." And I love to think of the church as the Rachel, out on the seas, picking up whatever orphans are still clinging to coffins out there somewhere, in the land beyond words. Thank you.